Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, this is Inside the Documentary, featuring breakdowns and interviews about all the latest documentaries.
Hey guys, welcome to the latest episode of Inside the Documentary right here on Popcorn Talk Network, part of AfterBuzz TV. I'm Bobby DeMuro, joined as every week we do this, by Ryan Malady. Across the table, Ryan, you can go ahead and eat right now. He's got food. You can just take it out. We can just put it on the table, let it be clear.
All right, I'll let you do your thing. I'm going to do mine.
We are talking. Let me introduce it actually before you take that bag because it's so loud.
Go for it.
But we are, the reason he's eating right now, we are talking about The Search for General Tsao.
Tsao, I guess.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But it's a documentary about chicken, about General Tsao, General Tso's chicken. If you've ever been to an American Chinese restaurant, you've eaten this for sure. Yeah. It is everywhere, and that's kind of what the documentary is about. So, in the meantime, we're live streaming this. We've got our phones on us, at Ryan Malady, at Bobby DeMuro. You can tweet us right now if you're watching this live. If you're not, if you watch this throughout the week or next month or whatever, you can still tweet us. You can still send us tweets. We'd love to talk about it. We'd love to talk about this film. This is, again, The Search for General Tsao, directed by Ian Chaney. It's on Netflix. If you haven't seen it yet, go watch it right now. If you have seen it, you're in the right place. And while you're here in the right place, remember, follow Popcorn Talk Network on Twitter at The Popcorn Talk, on YouTube at Popcorn Talk Network, and on popcorntalknetwork.com.
Beautiful.
Hit subscribe, do all that kind of stuff. Okay, let's talk about this film. I liked it a lot.
I did too.
I thought it was real good.
I thought it was tasty. It was like eye candy, eye food.
Yeah.
I never would have normally picked to do a documentary about just a specific food dish if it wasn't on the popular Netflix It's been popular for a while.
There's something to be said. We've been doing serious documentaries. Penn State, the Sandusky thing, the alien thing was ridiculous. We've been doing documentaries that people take really seriously, and that's fine. That's cool. That's why we're doing this. Mm-hmm. But there's something to be said for the kind of tongue-in-cheek. And there's serious aspects to this, the Chinese Exclusion Act, racism. We'll get into that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's something to be said for the tongue-in-cheek documentary about a piece of chicken. I think they did it well. It could have easily played on like the Food Network or something like that.
Yeah.
A little bit short. I would have liked them to go into a little bit more depth at points. Mm-hmm. But overall, from all the documentaries we've done, easily one of the better ones. It's not, you know, hard-hitting investigative journalism, but it's interesting. I thought it was real good.
I feel like the whole documentary was almost like a dish of Chinese food itself. It was like...
Were you tired afterwards?
It was like comfort food. And just like Chinese food, I wanted more an hour later. Yeah. It was good. It had a nice rhythm, good length. It could have been a little longer, but I feel like, it had a nice mix. It was a nice balance of kind of historical information and entertainment, you know, kind of the view of modern culture here in America and throughout the world. So it was informative and fun.
Let's get into, I think, maybe one of the biggest questions this documentary asks, which is about quote-unquote authentic Chinese food and how the American version of this chicken and everything Chinese food in America is not authentic. This was Americanized. It was interesting to see. I actually expected more of the Chinese and Chinese Americans that they interviewed to actually blast Chinese American food a little bit more than they did. I was interested to see a lot of them say, hey, you know, this is how you assimilate, this is how you Americanize, and this is how you make money. Like, this is how food develops and evolves. I expected more people to be maybe elitist about it. I don't know if that's a bad thing to say. I expected more folks, because food is one of those things like art. Mm-hmm. If you want to be, you know, very elitist and very high culture, you can do that. There are people there. It didn't come across. More people were open to, hey, it's a restaurant in Springfield, Missouri, Hammond, Louisiana. Yeah. It's serving fried food with a little Chinese twist. We're cool with it.
Oh, absolutely. You would think, I mean, especially the Chinese culture, food is so important in the culture that you would think, you know, whenever people, I always hear people talking, oh, it's not real Chinese food. I don't know what real Chinese food is.
You know, okay.
P.F. Chang's is like as close as I've gotten to China, to be honest. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of pride in the Chinese American identity, which seemed to be what the focus was when Chinese were coming to America in the first place.
Yeah.
The quick history lesson behind it was that Cantonese came over in the 1850s during the Gold Rush. And it's funny because you look at the history of different cultures moving into America, and each one, it seems, had their own bit of strife and their own bit of challenges. And the Chinese were no different. They had this Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882 that came out and just basically made it hard, almost impossible for the Chinese to get any work. Any honest labor. And so what do? Go into business for themselves. And what's lucrative? Laundry and food.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the history behind it. If you ever sat there and wondered, like, why are so many Chinese, you know, laundromats and Chinese restaurants? It's because they were entrepreneurs. They came and they did it, but they couldn't just bring their home dish. They had to Americanize it a little bit. Make dishes a little sweeter, make dishes a little, you know, more savory and spicy. The things that Americans like. And that just exploded into this whole world of American Chinese cuisine that gets a lot of bad rap, but I still love it. It's the comfort food of America.
Everybody does. There's a time and a place for it that everybody has. It's like Saturday night or whatever you're doing. Everybody has that brown paper takeout bag. You can get it out now.
I got it.
You can start eating now.
This is our special guest, General Tsao. Where did you
get this from? Just unnamed local restaurant? Not a national chain. It's a local. You just got a local takeout place?
Local. I'll throw him a shout out.
Okay.
Go ahead and thank you, Ping Pong, Chinese cuisine. It's Ping Pong.
Is it?
Right down the street.
Really? In the valley? Okay.
I called. They were here in like 5 minutes. It was
there you
it was
go.
Amazing. General Tsao. So, yeah. Yeah, your classic, your fortune cookies.
The fortune cookies were also talked about a little bit.
Not found in China.
Funniest scene to me. I'm glad you're pulling this out as we go. Mm-hmm. Funniest scene to me in this whole documentary was very short, very quick. I believe it was that fifth great-great-grandson or whatever of General Tsao, who claimed to be, we don't know if he was.
Right.
But the guy, he took the fortune cookie, and he was like, is this edible? Is it egg? And then he bit it and didn't expect the paper inside and, like, bit out the paper. It's really funny to see we take, Chinese food, fortune cookies. Well, obviously that's an American, you know, stupid thing. There's no Chinese back to something like that. You take it to real China, they have no idea what to do with it.
Yeah, what is this? Why?
What is this? There's a message in here? I thought that was a really funny scene, a really culturally... just a funny scene. I liked it a lot.
Oh, there it is.
There you go.
You know what? To be honest, I haven't had General Tsao's chicken. I want to say the ts and the ts at the same time.
Well, that's there's a lot of pronunciations. There's a lot of spellings. It's been Americanized, too. And the plastic fork. There you go.
So this documentary not only dives into the food aspect of it, the different cuisines, you know, trying to discover the origin of the recipe, the evolution of different Chinese cuisines throughout America, but it is the search for who is this General Tsao anyway?
Yeah.
And why is this chicken so popular and why is it named after him?
And that's, I think the history is actually the one knock I'll give to this doc. I wish it were a little bit longer. They went to so many different locations. Mm-hmm. They went to so many different countries. They went to multiple places in China, tons of places in the U.S., small towns in New Mexico, Louisiana, Missouri. That's a lot of locations to shoot, and you come away with an hour and 10-minute product. Now, time alone, it smells really good.
It smells really good. If only you had Smell-O-Vision out there in iTunes, you know.
Time alone isn't the only, you know, the duration of documentary isn't the only thing. Just because it'd be 3 hours long doesn't make it a good documentary. Mm-hmm. I wish it were maybe another 10 or 15 minutes, and they delved a little bit more into General Tsao. They delved a little bit more into the Chinese Exclusion Act, the immigration. Because when Chinese people came here in the 19th century, things were awful, like physically violent, awful. And I wish they delve a little bit more into that to understand the history. I think they almost, they sugarcoated it a little bit too much, maybe. They made it too, this is a fun documentary about chicken, which it is. Mm-hmm. I wish it had been delved into it slightly more, because I think then we would have been able to see how Chinese people in America assimilated and why. because they were treated so poorly, because they wanted to fit in, because they wanted to be successful, because they wanted to raise families here, and what that all meant. And I think that kind of got glossed over a little bit.
It did. Once that subject was introduced, and it's always, you know, whenever you get into the racism of early America,
it's
ugly, and you always got it. You're sitting here like, I have nothing to do with this, but I still feel bad. Like, I had something to do with it. Like, you know, my dad's from Egypt. I'm like a first generation. I still feel bad as an American watching this. So, yeah, they opened up that can of worms and then didn't really, do anything with it. Just kind of glossed over it. Said, well, everyone's happy now.
Yeah.
So they got their restaurants. And everyone's happy now.
They glossed over that, and in China, going to Shanghai, going to Hunan Province, they glossed over that a little bit. They had this great interview with that American in China, the American food critic in China. They talked to her for like 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
She's a great person to talk. You know, spend a couple film minutes, spend a couple hours with her, put it on film for 2 or 3 minutes, put on film for 2 or 3 minutes your time in General Tso's birthplace with the hotel and all that stuff. That's the one. I wish they would have delved a little bit deeper into that. Although I did like almost the quick hit vignettes of every Chinese restaurant, Missouri, Louisiana, you go all over the country. That woman in New Mexico, Tucumcari, New Mexico, the only Chinese family in town. It's so stereotypical, but you're like, crap, that exists.
I might have been there, to be honest, driving really through. Exists. I'm serious.
Now, I know. Now, why would you ever not be, if you ever have to drive through, because it's on I-40, I believe. If you ever have to drive through, why would you not?
Why would you not?
You gotta go.
Oh, hey, this random. what do you call it? Wang's Palace or
Golden? I think that one was Golden Dragon. Yeah,
and everything. Yeah. You know, all these very, very comfortable, non-threatening names like Happy Inn.
What about that guy? So the guy we met at Golden Dragon, actually, he was kind of weird, I guess we'll say. David R. Chan, the CPA, the Chinese American who had been to over 6,000, I believe it was 6,000 Chinese restaurants in America. But I thought his reasoning was actually kind of interesting, because his thing was sort of like, I'm trying to find a Chinese American identity, trying to see where I came from, or my people, I guess you'd say, my society, my community came from. That's an interesting thing, because we almost take it for granted, maybe. Maybe I do, because, you know, I'm third generation here in America. So you assimilate, your parents assimilate, you don't think about it, whatever it is, what it is, and you're just kind of here. But if you're quote unquote new, if your community is new, the Chinese have only been in America in significant numbers for what, 120, 130 years. If you're new in that regard, like a lot of cultures are, you still are almost, you're not lost, but you're still trying to figure out where you fit. And his personal journey, that's one I wish they would have dove into that a little bit more too, but that's a really interesting personal journey that to us feels superficial. You want to go to ping pong, dude? It's just chicken. But to him, it's like, wait a second, I'm trying to figure out where my roots end and where my future begins.
Exactly. So. Yeah, the very, very strong theme of the whole documentary was the Chinese American seeking identity in American culture. You know, not trying to establish Chinese culture in America, but to find their own place in this country, because it's a great place to be. And
they've taken advantage, like a lot of cultures have. You take advantage, you build businesses, you do exactly what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like after watching this, I don't even know what American food is anymore.
That's the biggest point. Like, that's the biggest and coolest point is, would you consider pizza ethnic food? I think pizza's pretty damn American.
Pizza, where's the pizza?
But like, to me, maybe I'm wrong, but I think pizza's pretty American. I never considered ethnic food. But at the top of the doc, one of the interviews is saying Chinese food's, you know, the second most popular ethnic food, only to pizza. And I'm like, wait a second, I don't consider pizza ethnic food. And then it made me think about it twice to say, wait a second, what really is ethnic? You know, there's obvious ethnic cuisine. If authentic Ethiopian cuisine is here, you've probably been to like an authentic Ethiopian place or an authentic Indian place. That's authentic cuisine.
You know, it tastes more authentic when you sit on the ground.
Sure.
When you sit on pillows.
You have a different experience than the American. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have a great quote from founder of P.F. Chang's. He kind of sums it up really well. It says, Americans embrace certain ideas about ethnic food, whether it's tacos, French fries, Swedish pancakes. They make it their own, and there's nothing wrong with that. Chinese American food is a style of cooking. It's a cuisine in itself.
Yeah.
So you have this Americanized version of Chinese cuisine that only came about because of the Chinese struggle here in America. It's like if America was just a completely open and, you know, non-discriminatory.
Even if it were non-discriminatory, I think it still would have evolved because the taste, because the food taste. One of them says, I can't remember who says it. I think it was the two in Missouri, in Springfield, Missouri. Let me look up their names real quick. Long's Asian Dinner in Missouri. Mm-hmm. David Leong. I think he was the one who said his place was the one that got bombed. But I think he was the one who said something about the Midwestern American likes the comfort food, the fried stuff. And so we did that with our twist. That's not verbatim. But I think it still would have come around just from tastes. Because, you know, Americans like what we like.
You know, what's funny is how they made that claim that, so they invented their cashew chicken.
Yeah.
Right? And then some, you know, food executives came down to ask them about the recipe. And then a few years later, Chicken McNuggets came out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if frying pieces of chicken doesn't seem like that crazy of an innovation, but it's still interesting how the little pieces of fried chicken came out before the Americanized version of chicken nuggets did.
Yeah.
It came out in Chinese cuisine before anywhere else.
Yeah.
And you would think chicken nuggets, chicken strips, that's a very American thing. You eat it with your hands, you know? But, I mean, this is a fork. Actually, I'm going to dive right in. I can't smell it anymore.
No, go for it.
I'm going to tell you right now how
it tastes. I'll talk about this thing for the next half hour while you're... No, I'm just kidding. One thing, actually, this is an important point for me because I always ding people on this, specifically on the internet, but really in life.
Oh, my God.
A lot of times, you'll see people talk about language.
That's so good.
And how language evolves. And you'll see language elitists, and there's a better word for that I'm probably not finding... And that's why I'm not a language elitist. You'll see language elitists talk about how much they hate emojis, how much they hate internet speak, you know, the LOLs, the WTFs, all that stuff. Because it's not language, it's cheap, you know, whatever. Language has always been evolving. It's always going to continue to evolve, internet or not. The way we talk in 50 years is going to seem so obsolete, you know. Mm-hmm. And we will evolve subconsciously because we'll evolve with our communities. This is the same way. Food is the same way. If you're a food elitist, and this was a big point in the documentary, food has always been evolving. You can't say, well, authentic Chinese cuisine is in the Hunan province in 1742. Well, no, it's not, because that evolved from the 1500s and the 1300s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always been evolving. And it was interesting to me to see, and maybe I give restaurateurs generally too little credit, but it was interesting to me to say that to a man, to a woman, the entrepreneurs in this thing that they interviewed, all the restaurant entrepreneurs, were all kind of like, you know what? We're here to make money. They said, you know, so much as we want you cook things people like. One of them literally said, you don't cook what you like. You cook what your customers like. You cook for your customers. And it's interesting to see that everybody is so common sense about that evolution when I would have expected the other way. I would have expected a ton of pushback,
right,
a ton of resistance. And most everybody was like, hey, maybe we're a little ashamed about the General South. It's a little weird. But it makes money. It's food. People like it. It's a cultural thing. People, you know, people support Chinese restaurants. This is great.
Absolutely. There's an immense amount of pride.
Yeah.
With every Chinese interviewee. And yeah, exactly. There's on the one side, I feel like every other American is like, that's not really Chinese food. That's not Chinese food. But yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Because a Chinese family made it for you. You know, and they've made the recipes for it.
Yeah.
Chinese American cuisine, and they're proud of it because it's so popular. And why not be proud of it? By the way, I didn't hear half of what you said because this was so good. But I do want to touch on that point that you made about language elitists and so, you know, just things evolving and changing, especially in this country in this day and age. To go a little further, I'd say technology.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of people always saying, oh, you know, get off of social media. That's not real life. That's not, you know, living. And sure, to a certain extent, some people waste a lot of time. But if you grow up in the new world with new access to new information, new people, new things, you're going to explore them. And if you're a new generation growing up in that environment, I mean, you're either going to take it one direction and do well with it, or you're going to be a lazy bum like people have always been. When literature was invented, I'm sure there were people reading encyclopedias, and then there were people reading comic books. And the internet came up, there's people, you know, interacting and learning, and there's people watching cat videos. You know, there's always going to be the polar opposites of people who appreciate things and don't. And to take it for what it's worth, I think it's worth a lot. This food's delicious. I've found a new appreciation for Chinese cuisine that I never thought. I didn't think that there was a veil over my eyes. I figured, that just a bunch of Chinese restaurants all have the same menu. Yeah. Somehow. They really do, though. You walk into every Chinese restaurant in America, and they'll have beef and broccoli,
mm-hmm.
sesame chicken. You know, and every critic will say those aren't really Chinese foods. But how did they become so popular? And how did they enter every single door of every restaurant?
Yeah.
Because they're good, and that's what people want to eat. And Chinese are making them because they make money. But it's funny how it all started back when there was discrimination. I'm still kind of wrapped around that. How mm-hmm. this whole cultural world of Chinese restaurants only really happened because Chinese culture wasn't accepted in this country. And that was the only way that Chinese Americans could dig out a little nook for themselves. Is if they started their own restaurant with their own people. There was even the Regional Chinese Association mm-hmm. assigns territories for, you know, incoming Chinese immigrants who need to go out and find jobs. And there's so many restaurants opening up everywhere all the time that they need to kind of like send people where there's a demand because there's so many. And these are people who are coming in, they don't really know English too well, and they're dispersed into the only network that has really been so strong since that Exclusion Act, which has been the restaurant business.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this documentary starts off by just asking, who is General Tsao? And why is this chicken so popular? But it just peels back so many different layers of just the whole Chinese-American culture, where it came from. And I'm excited that the Chinese-Americans are super proud of it. You know, because you'd think coming from a place of, you know, disrespect and discrimination and prejudice, that it would be almost resentful. You know, how the Chinese-American culture evolved the way it did. But it's not. There's a lot of pride, I felt.
And that's another interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up. Because the idea that so many of the entrepreneurs they talked to were so flexible. And so many of them were openly talking about assimilation, which every culture does. Every group does when they come to America, wants to assimilate. They want to retain what they have, but they want to fit in, too. It's just natural for humans. But they're talking about assimilation and how, you know, they just had to bob and weave. And if somebody was doing something awful and unspeakable and, you know, something that shouldn't have been being done 100 years ago, the attitude was kind of like, okay, how do we Americanize this and get that? Where do we fit in? It's such a march forward. You know, mm-hmm. it's not a resentment. It's not, you're exactly right. It's not a fight back. You did this to me. I'm going to do this to you. And I'm sure in certain cases there was a lot of that. And there was some bad situations because of the Chinese Exclusion Act. But generally speaking, the march forward to do stuff like this and to assimilate and then to make it so ubiquitous in this culture. Everybody has Chinese. Every town has Chinese food. Every town has one of these restaurants. Doesn't matter if you're on the West Coast like it had been for years or the diaspora that they talk about in the Deep South now, Hammond, Louisiana. That's not, you know, that's not a Chinese American community. Mm-hmm. That's not, you know, the target demographic you'd think. But they've got a very popular restaurant that has a lot of history, and they interview guys there. I'm thinking of all the little towns in North Carolina where I'm from that has Chinese restaurants. And now I'm looking back thinking, huh, they're exactly like this.
Exactly.
They're exactly like
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
And that's a good thing.
Anywhere
it's cool.
you are, you can just Google Chinese delivery.
Yeah.
And it's going to probably have what you want.
Unless you're in maybe, you know, upstate Alaska. Like, there's not many places in this country that's not going to have it. That's true.
Yeah, it might be lucrative. We should look into it. No, it's true. You can... I feel like it's the one genre, or I guess... Yeah, genre of food where, yeah, you can just Google Chinese delivery. It doesn't matter if it's ping pongs or Mandarin Garden or Canton Dragon. You know, there's going to be something you want because you're familiar with it and you love it. And I don't think there's anything else like that. Honestly, even pizza... You know, there's a huge difference between, like, Domino's and Pizza Hut. Like, I'm not gonna... I pick specifically the place I want because it's very different. But
that's
when it comes to Chinese restaurants, right?
And that's the difference. And, yeah, I mean, go on your phone wherever you are right now. And a lot of people have this. If you're in New York, you have this. But here in L.A., man, I'm struggling to find a good local pizza joint. And it depends where you are. But the thing about the Chinese restaurants that they've kind of profiled, the stereotypical ones that really are everywhere, yes, they're all serving the same food. They're all serving Kung Pao chicken, cashew chicken, orange, all that stuff. But every one of them has a twist. This mm-hmm. one's going to taste more or less the same as the next one.
Yeah, I noticed.
But they're all a little bit different.
When we were talking to, who was it, David Long, Leong,
mm-hmm.
who claimed to be the inventor, right?
The cashew chicken guy, yeah.
Right. You're saying there were scallions. I don't see any scallions. Oh, no, no, no. There's scallions, but there's water chestnuts, and I don't remember seeing those anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little twist right there. So now I feel like a General Tso's like critic. Oh, there's no water,
you're gonna
water
think, chestnuts. You're going to think about that now. Okay, so let's get into, speaking of that, how about Chef Peng? The originator, the creator, the man from Taiwan who did it, created it, maybe popularized it, and then never got credit for his creation.
Right, because Mr. Wang...
opened up shop next to each other, right?
Shop.
In New York, they're like a block away or
he
whatever.
He came up, opened up shop after visiting Taiwan, and he was inspired by the sweet and hot, sweet and spicy mix. Made some chicken, called it what he did, and then when actual Peng came in and said, you know what, no, this was my inspired dish, everyone thought he was ripping off the other guy.
Yeah.
How frustrated would that make you if you made a fried chicken dish and someone else ripped it off?
Actually, that's part of the assimilation. So Wang assimilated. He was here. He'd been here for a while. He looked for inspiration. They took this, you know, Chef Wang took this and came back and did it and got credit for it. And there was, you know, whatever else, Hunan Garden in New York in 72. There were all these restaurants that were doing this. Mm-hmm. And then Peng came here, couldn't speak English. Remember that part of the anecdote. He came mm-hmm. here to cook on that television show. He was great as a chef and stuff, but he spoke no English. That's a huge part of it. And he hadn't assimilated because he wasn't here long term. And obviously he's in Taiwan now. They interviewed him. He's not going to be in America long term. He's you know, Chinese. He's Taiwanese.
Mm-hmm.
But he never assimilated the same way. And I think that's a significant portion of why he didn't get credit is he didn't make himself part of the community. And that's not a criticism of him. I'm not saying he should have. He's probably a better fit where he came from. But he didn't make himself a part of the community, and a community member did get credit where he did not.
Yeah, and that's a bummer. Poor guy. But you know,
I feel like he did pretty well. He was cooking for Chiang Kai-shek, so
yeah, he did all right.
He was considering what else, I mean, no joke, considering what else was going on in Taiwan, you know, he was doing okay.
To be honest, I don't think any one particular person deserves credit. I mean, when you really look at it, it's a fried chicken dish with sauce in it. You know, I mean, ideas come in waves. If this guy didn't think of it, this guy would have, this girl would have. Somebody's going to throw this stuff together eventually.
They didn't invent an animal to cook. This is chicken, one of the most plentiful, bountiful animals. Really cheap, really easy to make, and it's just sauce. You know,
fry it, put it in sauce.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... I honestly don't, you know, really know who, even after watching it, I know that there's a few guys who introduced it, and that's where the popularity stemmed from, but I don't think anyone really deserves credit for the dish.
And that's
especially
part of the
not General Tso.
That's part of the beauty, right?
It is. It's a beautiful thing. It's almost like, and that's why the documentary was made, because it's such a phenomenon, how there's such a, you know, cultural explosion, but there's no real pinpoint. It's like one of those knock-knock jokes. It's like, where did it come from? Who told the, why did General Tso's chicken cross the road joke the first time? No one knows. But it's funny how, like, you maybe think maybe General Tso, your initial reaction is, oh, well, General Tso invented it, right? It's his chicken. It's General Tso's chicken. Or at least it was named after him because that's what he really liked to eat or something. But he really had nothing to do with it. Except for he was really respected in Hunan territory.
I thought it was something pretty interesting. This is a quick anecdote on General Tso, and I don't know if it matters for the documentary, but when they were giving his history, Qing Dynasty, 19th century general, best known for putting down the Taiping Rebellion. That was a peasant rebellion. The peasants, being mistreated at the time, rebelled against the government. He put down a peasant rebellion, was ruthless. Oh. I think they use that word in the show, in the documentary. He was ruthless. And he is worshipped in China, at least in that thing with the memorial and the square and the school and the house and the hotel and all this stuff when we go to China with that. It's a weird cognitive dissonance to have the everyman like worship at places almost, not quite, but almost, where this man put down this peasant rebellion just terribly.
He was apparently undefeated in those peasant rebellions.
It's just a little like, they were saying, well, he'd never been defeated. I'm thinking, well, he was like at times defeating his own people.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's interesting that he's so famous, but not really.
Yeah, well, there,
he's only famous because the chicken.
Yeah, well, here,
yeah. In Hunan, China, very well known.
But that's the weird thing too, is it's one person can mean such different things in such different places, mm-hmm. and we see it. I'll use this joke, but David Hasselhoff is so popular in Germany or whatever. To us, he's David. Are you kidding? David Hasselhoff, kind of a joke. Like, what are you talking about? Dude hasn't worked in 20 years. But German, and I don't know if this is still true, but a couple years ago, this was in Germany. He was huge. You know, Jerry Lewis was huge in France. Here he was kind of a joke. And it's like things click in other places.
Dennis Rodman was real big in North Korea.
Dennis Rodman was the man in North
Korea. The man. Like,
things just click in different places for us. You know, for us, weird things click in weird places. In China, when this documentary team went there, they probably thought the same thing. Weird things click in weird places. America's a weird place, and it is.
It's interesting how ironic it is that General Tsao is kind of like the mascot or the head, you know, the spokesman of this chicken dish, because of what this dish represents is almost everything that General Tsao didn't represent.
Yeah.
It almost represented the exact opposite. I mean, he fought to keep Westerners out of his territory. Didn't, you know, very, you know, Chinese proud culture, keep everyone out, isolate. And General Tsao's chicken is the one thing that actually really introduced stronger bonds between the Western culture and Chinese culture.
Yeah. It's one of the most American damn foods you can think of, let's be real.
Yeah, exactly. So General Tsao is now the connection between, you know, the
the East and the West.
The East and the West. And he'd probably be rolling his eyes at that, like they mentioned, but
so
it's just an ironic thing. So we get to the end of the journey, and it's like, well, General Tsao really had nothing to do with it, and it's kind of ironic. And this guy might have invented it, but the overall journey was really cool. I loved how I learned about Chinese American cuisine, not just like this delicious chicken, but there's also other cultures who have their own spin on Chinese cuisine.
Yes.
We were looking at, they gave some examples of the Indian Chinese cuisine and Mexican Chinese cuisine. Like, they'll have, you know, in Mexican Chinese cuisine, they'll serve it, you know, like beans and rice, you know. In Indian, it's a lot spicier and, you know, way more savory based on their tastes. So it's amazing how one cuisine can be so molded to shape any culture's tastes. And it's still authentic, because authenticity is really just where you call home, right?
Yeah.
Wherever you make it at home, that's authentic food to you. Authentic green chili to me, back at home at Colorado, I mean, I always thought it was like a southern thing, but I go to Texas and my cousin's never even heard of green chili.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but it's so authentic where I'm from. So you cross a few hundred miles, and all of a sudden, tastes are different, culture's different, but somehow, some way, there's certain tastes that tie people together. And there's a lot of taste in Chinese cuisine that tie us together.
It's food relativism at its best, right?
Mm.
Okay, I got to ask you about some people. First one, Harley Spiller, menu collector. 10,000 menus, 50 states and 100 nations, Chinese menus he possesses. That's an interesting hobby.
I think that was a clip out of Hoarders, actually.
Didn't we do that documentary about mail order brides like a month ago? He could have been almost a candidate.
It was interesting. You know,
is that too harsh? That's a little
too harsh. I mean, the guy has a hobby, you know? He has a Guinness World Record stapled to one of those boxes. Good for him.
Right.
I mean, it's funny how, like, this guy probably never really had an end result or end goal in mind when he started his menu collecting, but somehow it was necessary to go through his menus to find the search for General Tsao. We needed him. So I'm glad he did what he
did.
And
it's interesting. It's interesting that that's another American thing, and I don't know if it happens anywhere, because I haven't lived significantly in any other countries besides Canada. But I don't know if it happens in Europe and Asia and South America, but it almost feels like an American thing where if there's something to be collected, An American's going to collect it. I guarantee it. Obvious stuff, baseball cards, stamps, and coins and all that. Less obvious stuff, Chinese menus.
Chinese takeout menus.
if there's something out there you can collect, somebody, I guarantee, is collecting it. I'm looking at everything on this desk. Mugs, plastic containers, pens. For sure there are pen collectors. Sure. For him, I guess.
Tattoos.
100%.
There's only so much real estate on that one. But... But yeah, good for that guy. Good for him. What was his name again?
Harley Spiller.
Shout out to Harley Spiller. Thanks for collecting menus your whole life.
The interesting one. And they were interesting. That's one of those things you look through once, really, really interesting, but I don't know if I'd ever go back again.
No.
I wouldn't make it my life, but hey, I'm not Harley. Crystal Moe, American food critic in Shanghai. She was whatever, Takeout Shanghai or whatever. Mm-hmm. She's the one I wish they'd talked to more. She
had a grip.
Balances cultures in the exact opposite way that all the Chinese restaurateurs that they talk to balance them. You know, they went China to America, open up restaurants. These are first and second generation Chinese people. She goes the other way. She's first, maybe, generation American. We don't know. But an American in China dealing with food, I wish they would have talked to her more.
She really did drive it home. Yeah. I mean, I didn't really realize the cultural significance of food in Chinese culture until she mentioned how the very general "how are you" kind of phrase actually means "have you eaten yet?"
Mm-hmm.
When you're passing people down the street, "hey, how's it going?" You're really saying "ni chu fan le ma," or something like that. "Ni chu fan le ma," have you eaten yet?
Yeah,
that's like the general greeting when you talk to somebody. And I mean, yeah, she had a grip, and she really brought it home to me, which gave me more of that cognitive dissonance. If Chinese cuisine is so important to the culture, how could changing it so easily be so acceptable?
And yet it is.
And yet it's so yeah. acceptable. Yeah. You know, you would think that, you know, the Chinese culture would have so much pride that they wouldn't change anything, but they have so much pride that they're happy that people love it no matter what kind of twist they put on it. And that's what I love from it, is a people uniting in their passion for food. No matter, put pride aside and be proud of something worth being proud of.
Yeah.
I loved it.
It's an interesting thing. I guess last question, last couple minutes. We just got a couple minutes left. I'm interested in the way this documentary was shot, the locations, shooting style, music. What did you think of the actual logistics of this thing?
I thought it had some animation, music. I mean, you know, it's all original. And I liked it for what it was. You know, it wasn't too much. It wasn't too little. I mean, the music was, you know, it was nice. It was nice and happy, feel-good, comfort, like just like a Chinese dish. So, I mean, it wasn't, for what it was for a documentary about a plate of chicken, I think they did pretty well.
I agree with you. I really, really liked the animation. I thought it was really interesting. Gave it sort of a, I want to say Chinese feel, but it's probably what Americans think of Chinese feel with the animation and the style and the design.
China-American.
Yeah, there you go.
Why not?
China-American. Yeah, really, I would recommend this wholeheartedly. I don't know why you would be at the end of this show if you haven't already seen the documentary.
Yeah, check it out.
If you watch this entire after show without seeing it, you did it backwards. but I would definitely recommend that. I hope folks recommend that to other people because it's a quirky, weird, it's one of those things you watch on, like, you know, a Saturday if it's raining kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's not too serious, but it's like 70 minutes where you're like, huh, pretty good.
Yeah, it's not too long. It's the Goldilocks doc. You know? It was a nice little treat.
We do a lot of random stuff on here, but that one was pretty good.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
Almost as good as this chicken.
All right, eat up. He is on Twitter at Ryan Mallory. On what, every social network? Are you the same thing everywhere?
I'm the same everywhere I go.
There you go.
I'm the only Ryan Mallory, MALATY.
In the world?
Everywhere.
There you go. I'm on Twitter literally right now looking at tweets at Bobby DeMiro. So tweet us, guys, what you thought about this documentary. Or if you have suggestions for the future, we have a ton lined up. We've got some cool interviews coming up. Do your fortune cookie on air. We've got a ton lined up with some good interviews. But if you have a doc that is just being released, if you just saw something on Netflix or somewhere, you want our take on it, shoot it our way at Ryan Mallory, at Bobby DeMiro. Maybe we'll do it on the show. I know it's something we're always kind of looking out for.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. We'd love to hear you guys talk to us.
But that, I think that's it. Open up your fortune. Let's see what you got.
I got to say, all right, I'm opening up this fortune. You know the best fortune cookie I ever got? I said you will inherit an entire block in Beverly Hills.
Did it really?
It did. I was like, no way. All right, ready?
Yeah.
Let's see what this says here. There you go.
Now, what do? You put it underwater or do you just read it?
You just water.
Yeah, you're supposed to put it underwater.
Some people eat it. All right, it says, the sun will always shine through your heart, into your smile, and warm your soul.
That was perfect with the music. We're out. For Ryan, I'm Bobby. Good night, guys.
Wow, what a show.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.